Okay, so we've got next presentation is by Professor Tanya Lang and Tony Cox. And this is a presentation on preparing for key management in a post-quantum computing world. And Professor Lang is a professor at Eindhoven in the Netherlands and an expert on curve-based cryptography. Early proponent of post-quantum crypto, and she's a member of three different steering committees, including PQ Crypto. And Tony Cox is a VP Partners, Alliances and Sales for Cryptsoft. He's the chair of OASIS, a KMIP Technical Committee, co-editor of KMIP Specification Version 1.3, 1.4, and 2.0, and the chair of OASIS PKC S. 11 technical committee. So I'll turn it over to you guys.
Okay. G'day, folks. Thank you for that. Welcome to Key Management in a Post-Quantum Cryptography World. We've done the introduction, so we'll get straight into it. So, why are we here? So, this presentation is not just about the crypto. We've had a fair bit of that today and in the wider industry in terms of quantum cryptography and post-quantum computers, etc. In a key management context, we need to think about it a little more differently, or a little differently, sorry. We need to look at the nature of the post-quantum crypto threats in the managed key environment, the responses to those, and the ongoing ability to change and adapt. Reason for this, as we all know, the keys are in use for decades, so it means we need a framework to deal with it because we know the recommendations are going to change over time. And these keys are in use for encrypted data, signatures and their legal contexts, and authentication systems that go along with that. So we need to make sure that we're considering these threats now for systems that are going to be deployed that are securing data and these objects for decades to come. So for a little bit more about the threats and recommendations, I'm going to hand over to Tanya.
Well, as I said, threats and recommendation. Now, if you think that this thing is scary, that's much more scary. Because that thing is going to break all the crypto that we're currently using. I know that many of you have been here for the previous session, so maybe some of this is not necessary. But for those who just joined, Shor's paper, the one which I just flipped up after the monster, that is a paper which is showing that all the crypto that we're currently using, so if you look at the internet, if you look at specifications, you're very likely using one of RSA, ECC, or finite field discrete logs. All of those are going to be broken once there's a sufficiently big quantum computer. So Shor's algorithm just goes and turns something which is currently an exponential or at least super polynomial time algorithm into something which runs in polynomial time. So it really breaks everything that we're currently using. Now, there's a research effort that is pretty powerful in building a quantum computer. This morning, Mike Mosca was saying, well, please join me in embracing quantum, and I want to embrace quantum, but at the same time, as a cryptographer, it is a big threat because it's going to break everything that we currently rely on. And it is coming. So lots of countries, lots of agencies, but also like lots of public researchers, so universities and companies are investing in building a quantum computer. So my work is in Eindhoven, the Netherlands, and next door there is Delft, which is having a very big group in building a quantum computer. They have got funding from Microsoft, they get funding from Google, and it's just one out of many groups. And if you look at the Wikipedia page, it's actually a very good Wikipedia page, they are tracking how big these quantum computers get, and they're tracking how stable the qubits are. And based on that, it is something which is going to happen. It's not something which is like, yeah, good, the factor 15, kind of cute. This is something which is getting much more within reach. And now, actually, you get companies leaning out the window and saying something which is much closer. So Mark Ketchum from IBM was saying already in 2012 that this is like 10, 15 years from now. I remember when we ran the first conference on post-quantum cryptography, we had like 40-something people in the audience, and we asked the guy, well, one of the people who factored 15, like, when are you going to have a big quantum computer? He says, well, can't tell you. So we asked him, when can you, like, how much does it need? How much money do you need to do this? How much time do you need? No, he couldn't tell us. He was not even willing to say really when he could tell us, when he can tell us. He was saying, well, at least 10 years until I can tell you when I can tell you. This was like 2006. It's only 11 years later now, but we've gotten much more concrete to something which is within range. Now, I mentioned so far the public key systems. There's also an attack due to Grover, which is doing damage to symmetric key cryptography. So for an overview, symmetric, the guideline is basically it halves your security. So if you're looking at AES for key search, if you're looking at hash function for pre-match finding, the difference between the pre-quant security level and the post-quant security level is roughly halving the bit size. Difference is in message authentication codes. If you have something which is information theoretic, then a quantum computer doesn't have any impact. Otherwise, well, it's controlled. It's halving. You have to upgrade. You have to go to AES-256 if you want 128-bit security, but it's something we have under control. For public key systems, all of these that we currently use, sure, is going to break completely. Of course, if you up your key size by a little bit, you've gone by an extra year. But asymptotically, it doesn't buy you much. An extra year is not much on the scale. We're looking at secrets that have to be preserved for long term. I mean, if you're just concerned about the next 5 minutes, you'll be fine. But if you're concerned for anything longer than that, this is a big problem. So what can we do? Well, hide our head in the sand, return the dark ages. We can do physical security, for instance. I would be volunteering, depending on who's paying me and whether it's business class or first class or something, to be a courier, a trusted courier. You can totally trust me. I'll take a suitcase with a whole bunch of terabyte SSD cards and ship them over to wherever you need to go. Like, suitcase full will get you a year, so we can go back to the one-time pad. It's a little tricky to figure out. It's a little tricky to audit. Of course, trust me, it's going to be fine. But apart from that, well, it's not really what we want. Also, this is not going to help you if you need to do, like, secure system updates. This gives you a one-time pad, gives you a key exchange mechanism for the one-time pad. It doesn't give you anything for updates. In particular, it doesn't give you anything like signatures. So algorithmic cryptography, what we're currently using, what we're using on the normal internet, we have normal bits and bytes, normal fiber or whatever wire you have, Wi-Fi, normal zeros and ones, that is where we're looking for. We're looking for algorithms that stay secure against a quantum computer. Benefits of having algorithmic cryptography over having physical security is our security model assumes that the attacker gets a lot of information. The attacker gets the public key, the attacker gets the algorithm, the attacker gets the software implementation. They can see everything. They can audit it, they can certify it. So all of this is public knowledge, and still, the crypto is measured by remaining secure against this big threat. So we give everything to the attacker, and the crypto still has to remain secure. That's the premise of algorithmic cryptography, that it lives up to that security notion. And of course, we have to understand the security, we have to deal with sidechain attacks, we have to implement it securely, but at least we know how to do this. We have a roadmap, and we have standardization bodies, and we have testing labs and so on to go for that. Now, post-quantum crypto, already mentioned the word, that's cryptography that deals with the threat that the attacker has a quantum computer. It is not a statement like quantum safe. We're not saying, oh yeah, it's safe crypto. Well, of course, we are aiming for that. It's a security notion saying the attacker has a quantum computer and we have to deal with this. And typically, we try to deal with this by having our normal user use a normal computer. I'm today still using a laptop. I'm using a cell phone. My crypto has to run on this and remain secure for long term. Now, I mentioned before this 2006 conference, we had like 40-odd participants. Actually, this is a relatively young field. 2003, Dan Bernstein coined the term post-quantum crypto. Of course, this didn't come out of nothingness. There were some discussions, but it needed a term to have something handleable. But in the few years since 2003, this has gone into a research area, which is pretty big. So the last Pika Crypto conference had more than 200 participants. I think the last count was 338. So it's actually a sizable fraction of the crypto community saying, yep, we have to do this because, well, in the long run, everything has to be post-quantum. Well, there have already been some discussions of what we should do, and it's a little hard to say what you should do. I can, with the same emphasis, say, upgrade now. The end is nigh. All the data is gone lost. And seriously, everything that you today still encrypt with RSA or ECC is going to be lost. If this goes in the hand of the attacker and sits there till the attacker has a quantum computer, it's going to be decrypted. So that is actually a reason to urgently upgrade. Also, of course, we want to be up and running when a quantum computer comes, and unfortunately, nobody will send me a memo once a quantum computer is there. I mean, maybe some of you are in more fortunate situations, but as an academic researcher in Europe, I'm pretty sure that there will be a quantum computer before my colleagues in Delft are going to say, yep, we have one. I just won't know it. I don't know which part of the world is going to be first, but I'm pretty sure I will know only a year or two later. At the same time, we can say upgrade later. NIST has just called for a competition. There's going to be lots of submissions due by November. I'm sure that lots of the submissions there, once we have done the evaluation of them, will give us better solution, higher confidence solution, or faster solutions, depending on what you want. Confidence we have for some, but they're not really nice. Speed we have for some, but we're not so confident. At the end of the NIST competition, I hope that those two gaps have come much closer together. So that's the reason to upgrade later. Wait till the outcome. Also, once it's rolled out, it might be hard to change. So if you now settle on the inconvenient one, then everybody goes like, oh, but post-quantum, no, I can't afford that, even though in 5 years we'll have something which is much more convenient, much more affordable to use. I should put a caveat here. If you're actually concerned and you want to choose something now, it might be easier now than in November. I mean, in November, when you expect like 100-something submissions to NIST, you'll have an even harder time choosing something. So I would suggest either choose now or wait for 5 years. Now, what can you do? What can you do is we can do recommendations now. I wouldn't standardize anything. I think we can recommend to people if anybody needs, and well, with second part of the presentations, they needed something, they wanted something which is post-quantum secure. We can make recommendations and say, hey, look, this is what we have high confidence in. We're going super conservative. Anybody who is concerned enough to adopt it now is most likely very happy when in 5 years we say, hey, with the same level of confidence, we can give you now something which is smaller, faster, nicer, more convenient to use. So the user base who is concerned enough to use it now, the early adopters, will also be the ones who have an easier time changing. So my standpoint is recommend now, be conservative, but standardize later and have a general rollout in a little bit later. Now, we need to notify people. So I've been talking with people in the car industry. I've been talking with people in the banking industry and energy companies because some of their machinery is rather long-lived. They're now building in update mechanisms. So in principle, they can change the crypto. But what they really need is a secure way to update. Several people have said before, signatures can wait. I used to say that to many people as well, but I'm now saying signatures for those applications are the most urgent thing to do. Because if you have signatures in place that remain secure against a quantum computer, you can do the other part of the software update later. So there's really some different scenarios. One is you care about the confidentiality of your communication now. In that case, if you care about long-term confidentiality, you need to update to post-quantum now, even if it's inconvenient. If you don't need the confidentiality for long-term, you just need to have 10 years or something, you can wait for a while. But if your device is going to be out in the field for long-term, build in something so that you can change the crypto. Build in something so that you have update mechanisms that resist a quantum computer. So for the banking industry, energy industry, and for car manufacturers, those are people who tell me, yes, the device is going to be out in the field for 10, 20 years. And that is in the range where it's fairly likely that a big quantum computer exists. So they need something to update. And in general, people need to figure out where they use crypto, what they use crypto for, so make an inventory so that when we say, hey, we are confident in something convenient to use, they actually have a chance to switch over. And now we come to somebody who actually wants to switch over.
Thank you, Tanya. So we've heard there's some recommendations in terms of mechanisms, key sizes, etc. We know that we don't know when there's going to be a quantum computer of a size that's going to pose a reasonable threat, especially in a commercial context. But we know we need to take some form of action. So going along with that, we have a bunch of existing recommendations. So just looking at the keylink.com website here. Further, looking at the NIST page again from that site, we have a range of recommendations. They don't always line up with where we want them to be. Sometimes they're in conflict depending on which jurisdiction you're in, but we know there are specific requirements that people are going to need to implement. So the approach from a key management perspective is that we need to be mindful of but not specifically tied to the recommendations, because we know they're going to change over time. We need to focus on a framework that will enable the recommendations to be implemented quickly and easily. We need to ensure that the framework enables sufficient agility. As Lily was talking about earlier, we need to be agile in a crypto sense to be able to deal with these threats, and ensure that the framework will work in a commercial implementation, because if you can't sell it, it's got a fairly short life. In terms of handling that, we know we need to externalise key management from applications. That process has been underway for a long time. That's led us to standardisation in the space, particularly for protocols, so that we can deliver interoperability across enterprises, across vendors. And we need to ensure that whichever protocol we're going to select does have wide industry support. Which brings us to KMIP, Key Management Interoperability Protocol. There is a relatively complete but still a subset of vendor logos, but a logo soup there in terms of those vendors that are shipping KMIP-capable products. So KMIP won the battle in terms of the key management protocols quite a few years ago now. It is a clear winner. It has been adopted by the majority of the market. So, for those who already know what KMIP is, please forgive me. I'm just going to do a brief rundown on what it is for those who don't. So, back in the dark ages, like post 10 years ago, whenever you bought generally a storage implementation and you wanted encryption, you got a key management implementation with it. And that was generally running on a vendor-specific protocol. Moving to standardisation, you end up with one protocol, means you can manage kit across your enterprise from multiple vendors using a standardised set of APIs or calls. In terms of what it is, it's a wire protocol. It assumes a mutually authenticated TLS session. At this stage, we will allow 1.0 or above. That's going to change very soon with upcoming versions. In terms of the operations that you can perform within KMIP, I know the slide's getting a little small. Roughly grouped, we've got establishment, so your creation, your registration, creating a key pair, etc., your retrieval of those objects, management of those objects across their life cycle, and then key rotation and some other operations down to cryptographic implementations there, replicating the functionality traditionally delivered by an HSM. Going a little deeper, and I realise the text is still quite small there, but we've got the full list of operations at the top. The object types we're supporting, so there is there was previously a bit of a misbelief that KMIP was for symmetric key only. That is absolutely not the case. We're dealing with certificates, objects, PGP keys, private keys, public keys, the list goes on. And there's a range of profiles, which I'll talk about a little further on. In terms of the deployments of KMIP in the market and what they're actually using a key management protocol to do. In the storage environment, very typically, so your disk arrays, flash arrays, tape libraries, etc., generally vaulting a master authentication key. They will usually be sharing cluster-wide configuration settings. They will usually be looking for specific usage limits, particularly of the keys. In some cases, they will require FIPS 140-2 certified devices for creation and storage of those keys, backup and recovery of device-specific sets, etc. Moving forward with encrypting switches, very similar list, slightly shorter, generally vaulting device or port-specific keys. The same is true of encryption gateways and virtualization managers. Forward from that, we have compliance platforms and information managers, which are now being deployed across using KMIP. A lot of their usage is for fairly strict policy enforcement for both access and operations available on those keys. A significant amount of that is driven by audit and compliance requirements. So given that KMIP allows you to store a considerable volume of metadata about each particular key, you can actually track how it's used, for what, who used it. Depending on how deep you want to implement your system, there's a considerable amount of information available for audit and compliance. In endpoint security, it's very, very similar arrangement there as well. Moving on to key managers, so the servers that would generally house the keys, manage their lifecycle. So it's key and security object vault or store, the creation of those keys and security objects, performing cryptographic operations. Policy enforcement for access is usually something that you would get along with that, as well as policy enforcement on specific usages. So these users can create keys, that's fine, but deleting them, no, that's got to go over to a super user over here. Again, audit and compliance management, that's where the information is pulled. That's where you would generally run your audit and compliance reporting from, or at least that's the repository for that information. And then moving on to cross-device and cross-application coordination of those keys, user and device authentication, and multi-tenancy, multi-jurisdictional enforcement, applying that policy across different stores, different key groups. HSMs, we're now seeing HSMs deployed conformant to KMIP, very similar to the key management servers capabilities. And then we're also seeing authentication and identity management platforms where identities are managed as security objects with metadata. It's a fairly reasonable leap. You can then attach keys to those and move forward from there. Those are then deployed for external authentication, for access to storage, generation of keys, and validation of that authentication for other protocol support over KMIP. So in terms of moving forward, we need to consider these deployments and the impact that a realised PQC threat will have on external key generation. That will necessitate greater key volumes, and we need to turn them over a little faster, greater key links, as we've heard on a couple of occasions today, creating additional key metadata to allow us to better manage those and know when we need to change over. Additional and stronger authentication requirements, again, goes hand in hand with all of this. And of course, you've got different jurisdictions who will be adopting a different set of recommendations based on key lifecycle turnover, etc. You want to miss one then? Okay, so as far as the approach goes, KMIP being a client-server-based protocol, there are far greater clients available in the market. They will be sitting in, you know, your tape libraries, your disk arrays. I've covered all of that. There are more of them. They are generally deployed in technology that is turned over or updated a little less often. You know, it's stuck in a tape library, sits in the data centre. Somebody makes sure it's okay once a year. We're all fine. Whereas the servers, fewer in number, but generally because they're managing these endpoints across an enterprise, they have a much faster refresh rate, and that's mainly because they're considered part of the security environment. That's what they're there for. So the focus is on the servers in terms of making sure they're up to date. However, given that we're dealing with a problem that might be decades in arriving or not, we need to hit the clients first because they have a lower turnover rate. What that means is we need the framework to go into KMIP to deliver on three objectives for that, which is ensuring that specification has sufficient context or language to enable a more agile response. We need to provide the framework to enable the clients to request keys and operations and let the server decide what is safe. At the moment, the traditional use of KMIP is that the client will ask for an algorithm and a key size. Off it goes, the server will respond. We need to be mindful of the fact that things might move fast enough that the clients aren't updated in time. They need the language to go back to the server and say, hey, I just need something that's going to work for this period of time. Can you give me the right kind of key, please? And then further on to that, we need the ability for the servers to then ping the clients and say, hey, the setup you've got is wrong. You're going to need some new keys. You need to move forward. These keys are going to need to be rekeyed. I'm going to do that. And that needs to not be a surprise to the clients. So how are we going to handle this is in terms of what we're doing within the KMIP specification? Slowly, generally folks don't like massive changes. So in terms of the actual specification changes, we've got three new attributes. Not a great deal of change there. The impact of those, however, is quite considerable. So we've looked at a protection period. How long do we need the encryption or signing certification to remain safe? Sorry, Tanya. And that will be specified as an interval. Now, I've said maximum 135 years approximately. That's got nothing to do with how long I think things are safe for. That's purely a constraint of the specification. At the moment, we have a data type called an interval measured in seconds in a 32-bit field. Gives us roughly 135 years if my maths is right. In terms of a protection level, we need to say, you know, this is critical, this is not critical. And then a post-quantum crypto flag. We absolutely need this to be safe post-quantum, so post-quantum computer. So I mentioned profiles before. Within the KMIP documentation suite, we track things called profiles. We have ones for disk arrays, tape libraries, a whole range of uses. It is a subset of the specification for a particular usage. They will come along with specific test cases, which is a request response, and shows exactly how it's to be used. It allows us to measure conformance to the spec and provide very detailed behaviour, so when you're implementing a particular device conform to a profile, you know that it will work with the servers in the market, and vice versa for the servers, you know that you'll be supporting the endpoints in the market. And those profiles are being published quite regularly. So the profile that we have defined to go with post-quantum cryptography is effectively tracks two test cases, one for query, so allowing a client to query a key management server to determine its capability to cater for post-quantum cryptography, and a second test case for create, which I mentioned before, the client simply saying, hey, I need a key that's going to work for this period of time for this protection level that's post-quantum safe, and allowing the server to say, based on its policy, okay, you're going to need a key length like this. There you go. Here's your identifier. There's your key material. So just a brief shot of the actual profile that the Cambridge Technical Committee is currently working on. I won't go into too much detail there. We are recommending TLS 1.3, TLS 1.2 as a minimum. Whilst the syntax of the specification won't allow us to do this, it's effectively we would recommend 1.3 and we will tolerate 1.2. We can't quite express it that way. We also have the cipher suites down the bottom for 1.3 and 1.2 there as well. Moving forward in terms of the conformance statement for a post-quantum cryptography server, we've got the three attributes there, as well as a range of operations further down. In terms of the other content within that protocol, we're talking about the specific cryptography. We need to be looking at that to move forward. So these are mentioned throughout the profile in terms of needing to be able to support those. That's it. Moving back to you, Tanya.
I'm actually going back one slide. So this is the recommendations. Now, there's a lot of short names. I mean, like, if you're familiar with RSA and DES and so on, it's just another few letter abbreviations. Lydia already mentioned briefly hash-based signatures, and the digital signatures recommended here, Sphinx and XMSS, are hash-based signatures. I decided not to explain them here because those are fairly easy to understand. I'm actually going to focus on the encryption, the public key encryption part, so the part where it says key exchange shall use McAleese. So what does it mean to use McAleese with binary gobble codes and then some incomprehensible letters? What does it mean? So this system is part of something which is coming from the area of error-correcting codes, and this is something that you're, well, maybe not intellectually familiar with, but that you're constantly using. So if you have a computer and you make a choice between normal RAM and ECC RAM, the ECC there stands not for loop to curve cryptography, as much as I like ECC for that, but error correcting codes were around a little bit earlier and actually have a larger range of applications. So error correcting codes means that if your RAM is doing computations and it's hit by some cosmic arrays or something like a bit flips somewhere and your computation would come out incorrect, they actually have some redundancy in the information so that they can go back to correct this information. I think the poster child application for error correcting codes was CDs and DVDs, where you could make a scratch on the data and it would still recover it. So error correcting codes is an area of mathematics or discrete mathematics where you have some information and then you blow it up, you add redundancy, and the default thing you would just say twice. So when you're lecturing, you're always trying to say something in different words, you're adding redundancy. Now, this is a very boring kind of code. I'm saying it twice. I'm saying it with slightly different words. Error correcting codes are much better than that. So what you have in your ECC RAM, if you chose to go for it, is that you have a small extra. So you're thinking you have 64 bits. That's the logical bits you're dealing with. And physically, it's represented with 72 bits. And those eight extra bits are ensuring that if something goes wrong in your computation, you can recover it. So the area of error correcting codes is very much familiar with you have some piece of information, some bits flip, and then how can you recover it? Now, you have me on stage here because well, get in the mathematicians. So, well, once you have a mathematician, they want to talk formulas. And so if I want to explain how it actually works, that we can recover even the 64 bits, even if there was an error, then we need a matrix. Now, the matrix appeared earlier today, and most people are thinking of, that's the matrix. Now, as a mathematician, unfortunately, no, sorry, that's a matrix. Quick guidance on how to read this thing. So all this is doing is taking 7 bits, B0 till B6. Each of those is either 0 or 1. I put some data in there, and the only thing I know is if all the data is fine, if there has not been any error, then those three equations hold. So if I take B0 plus B3 plus B4 plus B6, then that is 0. So it's just 4 bits together, and there will be 0. If any of them flips, it changes a 0 to a 1. So that's just the top row of this matrix. So the first position is B0. Well, then on the diagonal, B1, B2. So that's you see in the system there, B0, B1, B2. And then similarly, whenever there's a 1 up there, the variable appears, the bit appears in these equations, and it also doesn't. OK, so now assume that you have your data sitting there. Something happens, and you check, and you don't get 000. What you get instead is 101. Okay, we have a pretty good stable system, so most likely it was only one bit that flipped. Can we figure out which bit it was? So look at these equations. The first one does not hold, the second one holds, the third one doesn't hold. You see which one flipped? Yep, B4. So B4 appears in the first row, does not appear in the second row, appears in the last row. B4 is the only one which has exactly this pattern that appears in those two rows and not in the middle one. So if it's a small enough system and it's only one error, we have a very good chance of figuring out where it was. Once we have a big enough system, this gets much, much harder. If you have a big system and many errors, this is a pretty nasty task. You can flip one, which will change a lot of equations. And then you flip another one, and it changes some back and some forward. So the area of code-based crypto comes out of coding theory. Now, in coding theory, there's two branches. One branch is trying to design nice codes, something you can use, something where you know exactly if you put in 50 errors, you can fix them all. This is what you want to use for your DVD. That is what they initially used for the Mars rover, like the very first ones that they sent up there. They wanted to make sure that whatever the Mars rover sends back, well, they can't just go like, hey, what you say? Because it takes a long time to transmit. They want to make sure that everything is really correct as transmitted. Now, that branch has given us nice codes. This branch has given us such big matrices where we know exactly how many bits we can flip and we can still recover it. Coding theory has also studied random matrices. If you have just such a system of zeros and ones, and you say, well, I want to have those vectors, those strings of bits that always give zero, how many are those? How close are they? How many bits can I flip in order to not hit the next valid one? So those are studies that happen in coding theory as well. And the area there has shown that if you have a random matrix, finding out which bits were flipped from the zero column to getting something else, that's a hard problem. For random code, we know it's NP-hard to even figure out whether there is anything valid within a range of T bits. So on the one hand side, we have nice ones where we know T bits are correctable. And on this other side, we have the random ones where we can't do it. Now, this is what we're using in code-based crypto as a public key, private key system. The private key is a nice description, one where we can efficiently correct, and the public key is a perturbed, modified version of this, which looks random. Here, it is a hard problem. So our attacker is faced with finding out which bits are set. Now, to give you some scale, because with 7 bits and one flipped, you had an easy time of doing it. The numbers that you saw on the previous slides are the dimension of this matrix. So this dimension of the matrix is 6,900 bits wide. That's also where you have to search your errors. And there's going to be more than 100 bits of those set. So if you're doing this brute force, you would have to choose, well, you have 119 choices out of those close to 7,000 bits that I said. And the attacker is given just this one long vector where he knows once he has fixed everything, it should be zero. So the crypto system is fairly easy to understand. All we're doing is we take, let me find the mouse here. Yep. We take this matrix. Our public matrix is the one which is hard to decode. And this is the information we're putting in. If somebody can decode it efficiently, the one with a secret key, that person can get this E. And the attacker is faced with the problem of finding E without having this system. So the attacker is faced with the general decoding problem, which we know is related to an NP-hard decision problem, whereas the constructive person, the one with the secret key, can just use coding theory for a nice matrix. So that's what it means to use McLeese with those parameters. And I should give credit where credit is due. So Lily already mentioned that these are old systems. So this is from 1978 by Robert McLeese. We're using a version due to Niederreiter, also from the mid of the 80s. So this is well-studied, old stuff, hasn't been broken, even though lots of people have looked. Now, why don't you have this on your smartphone? There's one problem, and I had this on the slide a few slides ago, that thing here, the key size. That is a problem. It is not a casual use. You have a 1 megabyte key that is totally fine if you're in a scenario like PGP where you hand over a key once and then you use it for a long time. And, well, we shoot in the system because we have confidence and we can use it a long time. But this is not a drop-in replacement for your TLS connection where you want to have a fresh key from both parties, ideally going each every way. So that's why you don't have this on your smartphone. It's not the lack of confidence. It's a lack of convenience. All right. With that, thank you for your attention.
I have a question for Tanya. So you mentioned the urgency of updating digital signatures in cars and other equipment that's out there in the field for a long time. And so I noticed you recommended Sphinx and XMSS. So any other family of signatures you think are ready? And the second part of the question is, would you deploy them in the hybrid mode, like along with classic signatures in some way, or just completely switch over to quantum?
Okay, so I should give a big background. So most of these recommendations come from the European project PKCrypto. So we got together a whole bunch of researchers and had a nice meeting where I came up with some dystopian scenarios where basically your life or at least your kidneys would depend on the security of your encryption or signature system. And it's amazing how much people drop their pet projects once they get to their kidneys. Those recommendations are the ones where people were basically willing to bet their kidneys on. So those are the ones where we feel like there is no chance in hell it could go wrong. Or a very, very small one. In particular for the signature systems, these are, I usually say, boring crypto systems. It's really hard to write academic papers about hash-based signatures because there's nothing to do. Now, for deployment, that's good news. For an academic, that's not so good news. One of my postdocs is an expert in hash-based signatures, and, well, he's branching out, and that's good for him because, well, once it's settled, then there's not so much you can do. It is a very easy scheme. You're just using that if you have a hash function, you can go forward, you can hash, and pre-image resistance means you can't go back. And you always use a hash function in signature schemes anyway. For hash-based signatures, that's the only piece we have. That doesn't mean it's the only thing we're looking at. So we're also looking at various lattice-based schemes. We're looking at multivariate quadratic schemes. We had not looked at the isogeny-based system because it's relatively new. Most of those come with benefits of smaller keys, or, well, in the case of hash functions, one of the two that we recommend is stateful, which is not so convenient for many things. So there are benefits in other systems, but we did not have the same level of confidence to recommend it, in particular when the size of the duration goes to 135 years.
Okay. Thanks.
Quick
commercial break. If you want to learn more about this, we're running a summer school and there's no conditions and whatever, but you can still register. Early registration closes on the 23rd of May.
That should be this one. Okay. How do you do this? You bring this thing up? Presentation mode. I guess I can just put it. There we go. Okay.